Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, best-selling author Scott Turow discusses his novel, The Last Trial, with Olivia Betty, a member of the AWM Board of Trustees. This conversation originally took place June 24th, 2020, and was recorded live via Zoom. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
My name is Kerry Cranston, for those of you who don't know me. I want to welcome you to the American Writers Museum Online. I want to first introduce our moderator for the evening, Olivia Betty, an experienced trial lawyer. Olivia has litigated and tried significant cases before the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Illinois and other federal courts around the country. She has also briefed and argued patent appeals before the Federal Circuit. Her industry-diverse practice includes the fields of biochemistry, chemistry, computer engineering, electrical engineering, metallurgy, nanotechnology, and mechanical engineering, among others. On top of this, Olivia is a board member of the American Writers Museum and a big fan of our guest author, Scott Turow. Now, Scott Turow is both an attorney and the author of numerous best-selling works of fiction, including Testimony, Identical, Innocent, Presumed Innocent, The Burden of Proof, and too many to list them all, as well as two nonfiction books, including 1L, about his experience as a law student. His books have been translated into more than 40 languages, sold more than 30 million copies worldwide, and have been adapted into movies and television projects. He's frequently contributed essays and op-ed pieces to publications such as the New York Times, the Washington Post, Vanity Fair, The New Yorker, and The Atlantic. So while I wish you could all let out a large round of applause for our guests that they could hear, I'll just say please join me in welcoming Olivia and Scott.
Thanks, Kerry. Hi, Scott. I'm so thrilled to be here with you to chat about The Last Trial.
Well, thank you for doing this, Olivia, and thanks to Kerry for the forum and the nice introduction.
Well, I'm really, really sorry to not be sitting next to you at the museum because of what's going on. But because of what's going on, we're able to welcome so many non-local friends here to the museum tonight. We have, I think, close to 500 people here. And due to the fire code, there's no way we would fit more than 200 normally. So welcome, everyone. Scott, this is your 12th crime thriller set in Kendall County. So, which as a Chicagoan reading it, it's pretty clear that Kendall County is based on Cook County. And I learned that years ago, actually watching Presumed Innocent with Harrison Ford in the elevated tracks. Right? After you graduated from Harvard Law School, you spent 8 years as an AUSA here at the Northern District, so our federal court. For Kendall County and the courtroom scenes, do you weave in characteristics from other cities you visited or practiced in, or do you just like make changes to Chicago to make Kendall?
I think I probably flavor Chicago with the other cities where, you know, I've been in the God knows how many years practicing law since 1978. So, you know, I've been lucky because most of my practice has been in Chicago. But, you know, I've been in a lot of other courtrooms over all that time, and was it 42 years? So occasionally I'll, if you ask me where Judge Klonsky's magnificent courtroom came from, it's really borrowed from the library, and actually the Chicago Cultural Center more than, and it's got more than a little bit of Cleveland in it as well.
Okay, that's fascinating because it doesn't sound like the Dirksen Building, but there are flavors of just the courtroom scenes, and I know you've tried so many cases there that you can't help but model some of that after the Dirksen Building. So Sandy Stern is our main character in The Last Trial. What is it about Sandy, out of all the lawyers you've written about, that made you choose to include him in every single one of your books?
It's a great question. And, you know, the truth is it has no exact answer, except that obviously all of the novels I've published have centered on the law. And Sandy Stern is, all things considered, the best lawyer of all of them. And so he's sort of the first citizen of Kendall County. He's not the mayor, you know, he's not a TV talking head or a celebrity, but in that world, he's the sort of the central personality. And it would be hard to be practicing law, especially criminal law, in Kendall County without making some reference to Sandy Stern, even in passing. And so that's the way it's gone down in all of these books.
So I had a law partner who passed right after we tried two patent infringement juries at the Northern District. And I doubt he thought those were his last trials. He was in his early 70s. How did you come up with the idea of making this, you know, the last trial for Sandy and having him age, you know, from the other books?
Well, I really backed into this book, Olivia, in the sense that in Innocent, which was the sequel to Presumed Innocent, which was the last time Sandy made a major appearance in one of these books, he had, mostly because I was aware of his mortality, he had developed stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer, and he had an advanced disease. And he tried the case. There was a huge strawberry mark on his face, which was a side effect from one of the chemotherapies. He'd lost, you know, 75 pounds. His suits hung on him like shrouds. And people who followed my work began writing to me and saying, please, please say Sandy Stern isn't going to die. And I sort of instinctively responded, you know, well, he's not going to die yet. But when I wrote testimony and Stern shows up in one paragraph as a guest at a barbecue, I began to say to myself, how is it that this guy's lived so long with such a serious disease? And I said, well, you know, maybe he's had some, you know, experimental or new therapy that's, you know, been life-saving in his case. And that is really how I started thinking about, you know, G-Livia, as I call this drug, in the last trial, which is the wonder drug that's both saved Stern's life and led its developer, Dr. Kirill Pafko, to Judge Klonsky's courtroom, where he stands on trial, indicted for a variety of offenses, including RICO murder. So why I thought about Stern on trial, I mean, it would hardly be a book about Stern if he wasn't on trial.
So you mentioned G-Livia. So I actually am doing a lot of patent work for a client, like cancer treatments, and the research you must have put in for this book is probably astounding. What did you do to prepare for all of those scenes and the background research and it's not just the technology you had to write about. You had to write about the marketing and everything else about drug development. And who helped you?
First of all, I had a lot of help along the way from my daughter, who's a pharmaceutical industry lawyer. And, you know, she was happy to correct my technical mistakes. So that was definitely a leg up. But I think all the time about the late Robert Parker. And we were on a panel together at the Art Institute, and somebody asked Parker how he managed to make all of his books, you know, so realistic and all the technical information correct. And Parker smiled and said, oh, I'm just a good typist. And what he meant is that he is a little bit like an actor, an illusionist, and all novelists are. And to some extent, I'm like the young person who gets asked to teach high school math and just stays a day ahead of the students in the textbook. So I learned as much as I had to learn. I learned a little bit, and then I figured out what the plot would be, and then I learned more. But I thought it was the most complex body of law that I had ever dealt with in the 40 plus years of practicing law. And as I like to say, it makes the Internal Revenue Code look like a nursery rhyme. So anyway, I learned what I needed to learn. And occasionally I took a deep dive when it was relevant.
I'm impressed your daughter went to law school. Did she read 1L first? I mean, that she went after reading that?
I'm sure Rachel had read 1L before she went to law school. I don't recall talking with her about it. So, but she's, you know, she's my oldest child, and she's read everything that I've written. I remember in Stern's first appearance in as the centerpiece of a novel in The Burden of Proof, she was 10 years old at that time, and I remember her paging through the manuscript, reading while we were driving somewhere. So I don't know how much of it she got as a 10-year-old, but I'm sure she read 1L as a result.
Well, I think it's a huge compliment and a testament to you being a great dad that she followed in your footsteps and went to law school. So Jonathan and I have two kids, and if one or both of them decide to be lawyers, like, we would love that. I think that'd be great.
I'm not sure her kids stand much of a chance because she married another lawyer. So there's going to be a lot of law in that household.
Well, I actually just read 1L for the first time. And even 19 years later, it was relevant. It brought back so many great memories. It brought me some PTSD. I mean, it was so well written. Did the classmates at Harvard Law School, did they know you were writing 1L when you were there? And for those of you in the audience, in case you're not a super fan and you didn't know, but I think most of you guys do know this, Scott taught law, writing at Stanford before he went to Harvard, and he actually had the contract for 1L ready to go when he went there. So he knew he was writing the book, but did your classmates know? Did your study group know?
My study group knew eventually. You know, eventually I realized who my closest friends were and who would be in somewhat transformed fashion, but who would be the central figures. And so they all knew. They all thought it was very, very cool until they read the book, which I let all of them do before publication. Then certainly one of them got, you know, fairly upset. And I've learned this subsequently when people say, you know, oh, I really want you to write about me. What they mean is, I want you to write about me very, very favorably. I want to look great. I want to be a giant.
And I mean, you did mention a Sandy Stern in 1L, but I understand that this is not the same Sandy Stern.
It is not the same Sandy Stern. When I sent in the manuscript for Presumed Innocent and was bought at Ferris, Strauss, and Giroux by the then young editor, now recently retired publisher at Ferris, Strauss, and Giroux, Jonathan Galassi, Jonathan went back and read 1L. And he calls me up, he says, you know, there's a guy named Sandy Stern in this book too. And I was like, oh no, am I gonna have to change this name? Something about the name Sandy Stern that I thought was perfect, you know, was the efforts at being, you know, American that was embodied in being Sandy and Stern, of course, with all the different meanings of the word. And I said, oh, I don't want to have to change this name. He said, don't change the name. He said, it'll be like a little parlor game for your readers. You know, is this the same Sandy Stern? So I didn't change it at Jonathan's advice, but no, they are not one and the same.
Is it hard to come up with new names? I guess because Sandy Stern was one that you liked and like stuck in your head. So every time you come up with a new book, there's all these new names you have to come up with. Do you have relatives helping you with ideas, or do you just pull them out of?
No, you know, I did get a note from George Will, who was a reader of my books. And as soon as it came out, and he said, Kirill Pafko, huh? Pafko. He said, this is a nod to the Cub fans, I take it. And of course it is. Andy Pafko was a famous outfielder for the Cubs. And so sometimes, you know, if I could, if it wouldn't become too much of a game and a joke, I would name every character for baseball players because they're the most wonderful names in baseball, you know. People with first names like Yonder, and they're great names. But there's certainly baseball contributes. I've never believed in that old, you know, canard that you should just pick up the phone book and decide, you know, just to name at random and, you know, well, okay, so she'll be Carol Channing. You know, it's, I don't, there has to be something visceral about a name, at least to me.
Well, speaking of names, Pinky.
Yeah.
Can we talk about how you came up with that name, and then we'll talk about Pinky some.
You know, everybody who read the early drafts objected to the name Pinky. But I was very much in mind of something that, you know, somebody said to me, you know, which was, this was a former school teacher who said the one thing that she had learned in the classroom was odd kids usually had odd names. And so Pinky, who is actually named Clarice at birth, was called, you know, Pinky by her great grandmother, who was simply too old to remember her name, just referred to her as Pinky because she was a rosy child. And the name ended up sticking. And I thought, just in the way that we're talking about, the oddity of that name was perfect for the character.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I had nothing in common with her, but she quickly became my favorite over all of her actions and how much she loved her grandfather. Well, is Pinky actually based on someone you know, or
one of your... No, you know, every now and then, I always say when you know a novel is going well, when a character who you never envisioned to start sort of picks up and runs away with the book. And Stern himself was, you know, was that character. I worked on Presumed Innocent for years on the morning commuter train and never got to the trial. I didn't even know who was going to be accused of the murder. And all of a sudden, Rusty Savage, the prosecutor, is accused of murdering his former lover. And now he needs a defense lawyer, 190 pages into the book, and or 120. And that was where Stern came from. And as I say, he kind of ran away with the book. Somebody wrote me a note recently. Oh, one of my publishers, Larry Kirschbaum, said that he reread Presumed Innocent and he decided that it was really basically Sandy's book, which I think may go too far. But he definitely ran away with the book, just as Pinky sort of, you know, forces herself in the forefront in this book.
Well, I mean, what is your issue with tattoos and nose nails? Do any kids have these ornaments? And
well, I have no issues with it. I would think that somebody with an 85-year-old grandfather, though, would find these things extremely odd. I mean, Pinky has got a 1-inch common nail driven through her nose, and she's tattooed everywhere that, you know, the casual onlooker can see. And I guess, you know, I'm growing accustomed to this, Olivia. I am somewhat happy about the fact that none of my kids have tattoos, at least that I know about. But, you know, I found myself, and I am writing about Pinky now in a new book, and she explains to somebody, she says, you know, you get born with your skin, you know, you're kind of stuck with it, but if you can change it. And that, to her, is the great appeal of a tattoo. So that's not in the last trial, but I'm sure that will remain in whatever I call this forthcoming book, assuming I finish it.
I mean, I was just about to ask you that, like, you could write a whole series on her as an investigator because she's just so interesting.
Yeah.
So I'm thrilled to hear you're doing it.
I am. And, you know, I'm growing more confident. Obviously, when you're writing about somebody who's several decades younger than you are naturally apprehensive about whether you're going to get it right. I am still proceeding carefully, but I'm pretty convinced I can do it.
Will her book also have courtroom scenes, or will it be more outside of the courtroom if her character is more of an investigator than an attorney?
No, there will be quite a bit of testimony in this book.
Okay. Well, I look forward to it. My husband, Jonathan, is a criminal defense attorney like Sandy. And by the way, I think he's the most brilliant defense attorney like Sandy. We met in law school. We studied for the bar together. And needless to say, like, we understand each other's days and we use each other to develop strategies. He does openings and closings on me. Your wife, Adrian, is also an attorney. And has her legal experience helped you with your recent books?
Well, you know, I met Adrian when I interviewed her, as she was then a law student at Northwestern, and I was on the hiring committee at Sun and Shine, as it was then called. And, you know, I recommended hiring her, and I thought she had a brilliant future as a lawyer, but I took it for granted that she was going to be a litigator, and she was just, you know, she's a somewhat forceful personality, not unpleasantly so, obviously. But anyway, she ended up becoming an estate planner, which she gave up when her first child was born. There are times when her legal education really serves her well, and you know, she can be. She always looks at me. She says, "I would have been a great cross examiner, wouldn't I?" You know. So, and she certainly can, you know, hold on to a point. So,
well, do you bounce ideas off of her for your books, or do you wait until you have a complete first draft before she does a first read? Because I know you put her in the acknowledgments as one of your first readers.
Yeah, no, I've been talking to her a little bit about the book that I'm writing now. I want her perspective on it, and she's already weighed in a way that I think was helpful and important.
Did she help with any of your perspectives with the interactions with Donatella? Is Donatella modeled after some of our ladies who lunch at East Bank or U Club or anything like that?
Well, Donatella is the wife of Kirill Pafko. And, you know, Pafko is this world-renowned scientist. And Donatella is very much a woman of her generation. You know, also in her late 70s. I think of her as brilliant. But one of those women in that era who assumed that she would have to live, her achievements would come through her husband's achievements. And that was just the basic deal that she made. But she's quite a formidable presence in her own right. And, you know, obviously I've known a lot of ladies like Donatella.
So here's a funny story. When I learned that we were going to have this chat, I spoke with the chief judge of the Northern District of Illinois, Judge Rebecca Pallmeyer, and she was really excited. She said a friend of hers was already reading the last trial and that there was a female chief judge in it, and was she anything like her? I started reading the last trial and realized right off, nope, you know, this female judge is nothing like Judge Pallmeyer. And I later learned that, you know, Judge Sonia Klonsky, or Sonny, has been in many of your books and was the main character in Laws of Our Fathers. But did you decide to make Sonny the chief judge before or after Judge Pallmeyer assumed the role as the first female chief judge of the Northern District in all of its 200 years in existence?
Well, I've known Judge Pallmeyer for many, many years. Including having sat on the Judicial Selection Commission that recommended her to Senators Durbin and Mosley Braun. So I go back a long way, and, you know, our kids were peers in high school. They were in the same high school class. But despite my great admiration for her, I have to say that Sonny being the chief judge was almost a matter of mathematics. And I do keep track about what I have said about these characters. So Sonny years ago was a state court judge. And in one of the novels in passing, it said that she moved on to the federal bench, which usually is regarded as a promotion, if for no other reason than you get life tenure when you become a federal judge. So she had to be somewhere near 70. I just said, you know, logically, she's you know, a really experienced judge, and it would be a little more fun and a little more interesting if she were the chief and really the person who essentially in a courthouse is the central character in the operation of that courthouse. She's the highest ranking official in that courthouse. And a lot of administrative stuff goes through the chief judge. So I wanted her too to be not just a powerful person, but somebody who was accustomed to being powerful. And like all the rest of us, she's not perfect. She's, as happens to judges over the years, she's become a little short-tempered on the bench and quickly exasperated by lawyers because they've seen every trick 100 times. I love Sonny Klonsky. She's another of my favorite characters. And I think she does a good job with this trial.
She did. She really did. Well, I think a lot of people on this Zoom call, including myself, work full time, and we feel like, especially with the quarantine, there's just so much going on, you know, it's hard to keep up. Somehow you managed to do 2 full-time jobs, which is your partner, Denton's, which is a global law firm, and you write all of these books. Like, how in the world do you do it all? And like, when do you do your best writing?
Well, the secret, of course, is that I have practiced law only part-time since 1990. And part-time has meant less and less legal work as the years have gone on. After Presumed Innocent, I asked my partner's acquiescence to begin spending a significant part of my time on pro bono work. And there was a period of time when I was working, I was supposedly part-time, but I was really working full-time because I had both, you know, the regular paying clients and very significant commitment to pro bono cases. And I probably will continue to do some pro bono work, but I think my days practicing on paying cases are probably coming to a close shortly. I've enjoyed to whatever extent I've been able to mix the two callings. I've really enjoyed it. You have to, I always say that the thing that's allowed me to do it is that I'm not like not most writers, but some writers who have to be in a cork-lined room because they can't stand to be disturbed. And the biggest talent I've brought to doing both things has been that a client can call me while I'm at home writing, and you learn which clients you can trust with your home phone number. Of course, these days everybody's got your cell, but I can talk to the client about a complex issue, put the phone down, and go back to the sentence that I was writing without a hitch. And a lot of writers can't put up with those kinds of interruptions. They leave their own flow state and they can't get back into it. So that's one of the reasons I've been able to combine the two careers.
So I personally think that the courtroom scenes would be the hardest scenes to write out of your book. Do you find that to be true, or do you think that those are the easier ones for you to write? And by the way, I really, really appreciate those scenes as a trial lawyer that you really stick to the law and you don't just like kind of dramatize it or throw things around all loose like they do on TV.
I have to admit, everybody who has been a prosecutor has the rules of evidence like burned onto their heart. And so for me to write the courtroom scenes was pretty automatic. And obviously I rewrote them and sharpened them. But the mechanics of it is really, after all of these years, pretty much second nature to me. So, and the rules of evidence. And I think being in court, and I don't know how you feel about this, Olivia, but I think it's inherently dramatic. No matter what the case is, you're engaged in this confrontation between Two people, whether it's the government and a criminal defendant or even a civil case, two people who are in deep conflict with one another, and that's being worked out through the law and through the lawyers, and there's this confrontation called cross-examination. It's dramatic, and people walk into courtrooms and can't make themselves leave. So I've never understood why you need to break the rules.
I love it. It's thrilling. That's interesting. You bring up cross-examination. So kind of a preview to the Q&A that's coming up soon. I did have a chance to speak to one of your former AUSA buddies, Judge Thomas Durkin. He submitted a question for us. He wanted to know what your hardest cross-examination was that you've done.
As a prosecutor myself or as a defense lawyer?
He didn't specify, but is there one that sticks in your mind? There must be one that just...
Well, you know, it's oddly topical, but I tried a police beating case involving one of the West Suburban Police Departments. And they're very tough cases for people who have been watching current events in the United States. It's just very, very hard to convict a cop of using excessive force. But I indicted one of these cases and I thought I had the case nailed down, and you know, then the cops came in and when they were scared for their own well-being, they had told one story in the grand jury, and then they sat on the witness stand, and you know, cops are very bright, certainly very familiar with what's going on, and they altered their testimony so that they were almost like finding the loopholes in what had been said in the grand jury. And I remember those as particularly difficult crosses, just because even when the guy had flipped me and even when he was contradicting his grand jury testimony, I could tell that the jurors didn't care. And, you know, they didn't want to convict a cop.
Sounds really, really difficult. And thank you for sharing that with us. Thank you so much for being here. I want to read one last comment who's from the founder of our beautiful museum, the American Writers Museum. For those of you who haven't been there, once this all is over, please come to Chicago. Please check out our amazing gem of a museum. So Malcolm O'Hagan, who lives in DC, wrote, "Thanks, Scott, for doing this a totally engaging interview and for your support of the AWM. If I wanted to be a successful litigator or investigator, all I would need to do is read all your books. There should be a Thoreau degree."
Well, Malcolm O'Hagan, for the few people who haven't met him, is one of the most charming human beings on the face of the earth. And when he first talked to me about this museum many years ago, I was doing a book event in DC, I thought he was, you know, he had the vapors, that this was impossible. And this museum is a living testament to Malcolm and what one person with a great idea and indomitable will can accomplish.
And charm. Got all of us to get in there and work on it. So thank you so much again, Scott. I can't wait to read about Pinky and all of her adventures. And thank you all so much for listening in.
Thank you. Thanks for doing this, Olivia. Thank you.
Thank you and good night.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, editors Nina Bennett and Marie Bennett discuss Gertrude Beasley and her memoir, My First 30 Years, a book that was banned upon its release in 1925 and lost to history until now. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.